With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Because I didn't really have very much as a child, I kind of created this yearning for nice things. I just fell in love with beautiful cars or nice things in life. And
this is Property Investory, where we talk to successful property investors to find out more about their stories, mindset, and strategies. I'm Tyrone Shum, and in this episode, we're speaking with property investor Giles Hill, who's renovated and developed properties for more than 3 decades. He shares how he bought his first investment property as a student for over 3 times the cost of his parents' house, how he managed to live there rent-free, and much, much more. Being a family-orientated guy, Hill spends most of his time on the domestic side of things, since he has the time and freedom.
Currently, I've focused on property and family life, which is I'm very fortunate to do so. And in my property business, I help others achieve wealth through property investments. And I have quite a clear strategy, which has worked for myself, which I like to help and assist others to achieve similar success. A typical day for me is pretty relaxed. I like to start the morning with a walk or a swim or a bit of yoga. I spend time with my kids and get them off to school, and do some household chores. I'm the person most kind of responsible for running my house. My wife has a busy job. And once that's done, my day is typically involved with meeting prospective clients, potentially looking at properties or checking on to see how development projects are progressing, and also meeting with my referral network and the people who I get most of my business with, who I work together with in my virtual team.
That's great. It sounds like you've got a very relaxed kind of family life based around. Is that how you designed it initially when you first think, okay, I'm going to run my own business? I want to base everything around that kind of lifestyle?
Yeah, not really. It's probably not that strategically planned. I think it's just something which has changed as life has changed. I had children probably later in life than a lot of people, and I hadn't really planned what that would look like going forward. But I've been fortunate to be able to adapt the way I live to suit how I want to live and how I want to spend time with my family.
That's great. And can I ask, how old are your kids?
My kids were, it's interesting, my son's birthday was this week, he's just turned 12, and my daughter's birthday is next week and she turns 10.
He grew up in a very small and traditional village in the middle of England where everyone knew everyone. He experienced a simple country lifestyle.
I went to my junior school or primary school locally to where I was, and it was a tiny little school, like one of those little character Peppa Pig sort of schools. And there was 53 children in the school in total, and that included like the kindy and the age my son is now, up to high school. And I was in a year and there was 11 children in my year, and I was the only boy.
That would have been quite interesting. So did that change over time?
Shortly after I started at high school, my parents actually relocated us to another part of England, to Cornwall. So people who aren't familiar with England, if you look at the map of England, that's right down in that sort of left-hand bottom corner, that big toe. And we moved down to that area. But it was an interesting education, that little village school. I think for many years prior to almost about the time when me and my sister started to go to that school, it had been ran by a headmistress who had a little house next to the school. It was very, very classical in its approach with then, and the school itself was just divided into 2 big classrooms. But that lady, she retired after probably 50 years, and she was quite a strict disciplinarian. And then we had a new teacher come in who was kind of a funky, this would have been like, what was this, like 60s, 70s, with a completely different approach to how children should learn. She was a free spirit, and we very much were left to our own devices to do what we wanted to do, and that was and learn as we went. But unfortunately, I don't think we learned that much, and it became a bit of a challenge by the time we went to high school. And we were classed or streamed with children who had perhaps had a more stringent or structured primary school education. So I think it was a little bit of a challenge to catch up again after that.
Was the move from your original town to Cornwall a big change for you as well too? Because as you say, it was a much smaller town.
It was interesting because we went from being in a little village to being in a much more remote place. It was a big life change as far as, when we were in that village in the Midlands, it was, we were like most of the other families, but when we went to live in the middle of kind of nowhere in deepest, darkest Cornwall, we were very remote. And my parents bought an old house it was about an acre of land, so a fair chunk of land. And they basically took on a lifestyle of self-sufficiency. So they didn't go to work. We didn't have very much money. We didn't have holidays, but we were self-sufficient as far as growing our own vegetables and having goats and ducks and chickens to contend with.
That is so cool. I mean, like you think about that now, like everything's so modernized, everything's so industrialized. We get our food straight away just down at the supermarket. But going back to the times when we actually had to farm for our own food, grow it and so forth, makes you really appreciate, how long things do take. Because I'm even, at the moment growing some carrots and some tomatoes in the back, and you're so used to just picking up off the shelf in the supermarket and it's there. But like you realize there's so many different seasons, the timing and so forth, and you learn to appreciate life a lot more. And that I think is something that we all miss, and we kind of go, oh, I really want that kind of freshness, organic kind of thing back in our.
Yeah, it's funny. We have a little vegetable patch here at our house in Sydney, which is a lot of fun. I think it's great for the kids to see that. But there is a flip side. I think as a kid, we went to such a remote state of living, and so lacking in interaction with other people. I don't think it was really the best way to grow up. And I think as you get a little bit older, You just want to be with other people, and you want to get out of that situation. So I probably left home as soon as I could after that to try and go and explore the big wide world.
In hopes of escaping the rat race, seeking more space and a much quieter and humble existence, Hill's parents made a decision to move.
They'd grown up in Leicester, like post-war Leicester, and they just, for them, our village was obviously was 10 miles or 16 kilometres outside of the city of London, city of Leicester. But they just felt that there was a massive amount of change, and they didn't like what they saw going on. So they decided to escape the rat race, if you like. And it's a time of major growth of within the UK.
A lot of times I hear that a lot of stories in the past that I've had guests on the show, they've always talked about the reasons why they've moved, because I've had a number of guests, some guests have moved six times in 2 or 3 years with their parents because of their work and jobs. This is a sort of a little bit different perspective in life to be able to see why they've moved. So it's an interesting fresh change. Are your parents still alive at this point in time?
They're still alive, and interestingly that property which they would have bought maybe 45, 46 years ago when they bought that house, and it was a house which needed a lot of work doing on it, and they never went back to employed work. They just worked on their own land and on the renovation of that home, which is probably something which I started to learn or become somewhat curious about property construction from that stage, because I had to help my dad with the renovation and work on the house. And interestingly, they're still working on that house today. It's like a never-ending project.
At what stage did you actually leave the nest, I guess you can say, and start to explore the big world?
It was a little bit unfortunate. So when we moved from Leicester to Cornwall, we moved at an age where I just missed out on doing what then was called the 11 plus. So they used to stream children, and if you were successful in the 11 plus test, then you would go to what might be a grammar school or more academically focused school, and if you were unsuccessful, then you went to a school which is perhaps more like technical or vocational kind of courses. And I didn't take the test because in Leicester, where I was schooling at the time, they'd already abolished it. They moved to a new way of working, which was comprehensive education. But in the county of Cornwall, they were still operating in that older model. And because I got what was kind of the teachers at the school I'd been at, I was there for one term, the secondary Gould and Leicester. They wrote me nice reports because they didn't really know me. I'd only been there a term. But consequently, people read that and thought I was a bright kid. They put me in the grammar school, which obviously was much the delight of my parents and my grandmother and people who thought that was quite prestigious. But it probably wasn't the best place for me because academics were not my strength. And also because of that, you know, slightly disjointed primary school education I'd received, where you taught yourself, I just struggled. And it wasn't really, you know, and I struggled throughout that school. I would have been better off in the more technical school. The only subjects which I excelled at were woodwork, metalwork, technical drawing, and ceramics. So I was, you know, I had a strong practical aptitude. In fact, I was, you know, very, very good at those subjects. But I struggled with my maths and physics and chemistry and Latin and the subjects which we had to do with, you know, within the academic framework of the grammar school.
After finishing high school, Hills pursued a higher education. Although he admitted to struggling with a more academically centered curriculum, he followed the herd, so to speak, and followed the same academic basis.
It's called A-levels. I did biology and chemistry, and you weren't allowed to be a part-time student. So I had to fill in the time, and that's when I started to do so. I did like ceramics and some more technical drawing type subjects, which I excelled at. At the end of that period of time, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. And perhaps a little bit unfortunately, my father, or the way that they worked, their view was to kind of do as little as possible, which is why they decided to get out of the work life and go and sit in a piece of land and grow their own vegetables in Cornwall. And my parents didn't have any real, we didn't have any mentors or anyone else close to our family. We had no cousins, we had no friends, we didn't have anyone else to really give me much influence in life. So consequently, I kind of also grew up perhaps a little bit thinking that you're taking the easy option or doing as little. I think my dad told me to tell the career guy that I wanted to get paid as much as money as possible for doing as little as possible, which didn't go down particularly well with my careers teacher.
Coming up after the break, we hear about Hill's early career goals.
He was finishing school at, you know, 4 o'clock every day and going for a surf. And he was, you know, he had 12, 14 weeks holiday a year. And that seemed to have some appeal.
We learn about his change of direction fresh out of university.
So I embarked on that career and I just loved it. It was, yeah, I loved the camaraderie of the team environment. I enjoyed visiting, you know, business owners. And
Hill shares how he managed to live rent-free in his first investment property.
This is what resonates with the guy from Plymouth, is I decided I'd go and buy a house. So I bought a four-bedroom house as opposed to a one-bedroom apartment.
And that's up next. I'm Tyrone Shum, and you're listening to Property Investory. Hill didn't receive much of a push from his father to carry on his education, so he took matters into his own hands.
When I was doing my A-levels, I met a teacher there who was teaching the ceramics or pottery class, which is one of the ones I did to fill in my timetable. And he seemed to have a pretty cushy life. He was only a young guy, but he was enjoying what he was doing. He was teaching kids who were at school because they'd chosen to be at school, because they had moved into those years of school where you were there by choice. And, you know, he was finishing school at, you know, 4 o'clock every day and going for a surf. And he was, you know, he had 12, 14 weeks holiday a year. And that seemed to have some appeal. So I left college and I went to do a 4-year degree to train to be a school teacher. So it's called a Bachelor of Education Honours degree. And I did it in the city of Plymouth, which is also in the southwest part of England. And did that for 4 years.
Nice. So that appeal of, you know, having a very cruisy life where you could just finish up at four, go for a surf and stuff like that, were you able to still achieve that as a teacher?
Well, do you know what I did? What happened to me is, I don't know what it was. There were some early influences in my life because I didn't, and I don't know, it sounds a little bit sad, but because I didn't really have very much as a child, I kind of created this yearning for nice things. I just fell in love with beautiful cars or nice things in life or nice homes and just luxury things. I think just had some mass appeal to me. And what happened is when I was whilst I was doing my degree course, which was for 4 years, each of those years you went into a school and you teach for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks or up in the final, you spend a term in a secondary school teaching. And it was, you know, a really, you know, very powerful learning experience. There's just so many different things that you learn from that exercise. But one of the things I did identify was that the teachers who I respected the most, who were helping me learn, were typically teachers who had perhaps gone outside of the educational network. Because there's teachers who go from school to college and back into school. And then there was teachers who went from school into industry and then back into school. And these guys just seem to have much more life skills and much more interest. And some of them said to me, go and do something, go travel the world or get some skills and then come back into teaching. It's not a bad thing to do. So that was part of the reason. Also, teachers historically were not particularly well paid, and they're still not proportionally to the amount of training they do and the amount of, you know, the importance of the job which they fulfill. But at the end of my 4 years, I decided to go into work and I went to try and earn some money. I joined a company which took on 8 trainee sales people. They only recruited graduates. You're on a graduate sales training program. It was really exciting because it was closer to London, which was a more exciting part of England than the Southwest, where I'd obviously grown up and where I'd been studying. So I embarked on that career, and I just loved it. It was I loved the camaraderie of the team environment. I enjoyed visiting, you know, business owners and talking about how, you know, technology or telephone systems, new types of technology, could support their business. And yeah, and I had a lot of success. Yeah, relative to my experience.
Hill decided to move into a totally different direction from what he had previously studied.
It was an interesting time in telecommunications because for many, many years, all telecommunications had been state-owned. So it was called like British Telecom, or before that it was the Post Office and British Telecom. And this was at the time, so this was in the mid-80s, when the market was liberalised and competition was introduced. It's interesting, a lot of people were using very old technologies, and then all of a sudden there was new technologies being brought into the country. And then I had, I was one of the salespeople running around small businesses, illustrating to them the benefits that they could achieve by updating their technology. It was a lot of fun.
That is a lot of fun. So what's some examples? I mean, our technology has changed so much. I remember the days when we had our physical phone, which we had to pick off the wall and dial, to nowadays we're just all mobile.
Historically, they'd had like old-fashioned technology whereby it was a little telephone exchange located in the business, and there'd be someone there who was the switchboard operator, and they basically, if you called and you wanted to speak to the manager or director, they'd be putting out a plug from the telephone line and connecting it to the cable which went to his office. It was that old. And then it became a little bit more sophisticated, where they'd be flicking switches to connect them, and then with this new technology allowed people to very quickly just transfer calls within a business environment. So it was kind of cool that there was just such a significant change from what had been been in place for many, many years. All of a sudden, significant change. And this is really the start of the kind of dot-com boom as far as technology was concerned.
Yeah, that is phenomenally fascinating. Because, I mean, I remember watching in movies and stuff like that where they have the switch operators, the ladies usually just sit there just pulling plugs and plugging things in. And then, obviously their role becomes kind of redundant after a while when we replace it with switches, the physical devices that just does it automatically. So they would have to be retrained to do something else, or they may, become redundant and have to go and upskill in something else.
Yeah, I mean, it was at a growth time. So there was always, there was always other opportunities. And they still had a switchboard operator. It was just that they maybe had a headset and they could, had a keyboard as opposed to plugging things in and out. It was just like they couldn't believe it that you could, they could see if someone was on the phone or not just by looking at this device. Whereas before, they'd have to call it and then, because they had no status of what someone's business was. And if they couldn't find the person or they weren't in the office, then they could just page into the warehouse or something saying, call here for Dick Jones, and he could go to any phone and pick it up. And people were like, wow, this is incredible. This is going to save our business so much time and improve our efficiency significantly. So it was kind of fun to do that. And the great thing about it was that it just seemed like I'd been a student for 4 years, and I used to get £2,000 a year as a government grant, because my parents didn't work. That was like the maximum grant you could get, and that's what I'd live on. And I remember it wasn't all that long after that I'd had some success in selling and getting $2,000 in a month in a paycheck, and it just seemed like it was all the It just seemed like it was all the money in the world. And I treated myself to a couple of things, some of which I still have today, just celebrating that success. But other than that, you know, I was a saver. You know, I just had never had access to any money to spend, and that's probably what started me on thinking about buying a property.
So, how long was Hill working in sales before he decided to move into the property space?
I kind of progressed to more complex sales or more senior roles, and you know, to ultimately I was running, you know, when I came to Australia, I was running a team of, you know, 120 salespeople across Australia. So I moved into sales management, and I worked in telecommunications / IT sales for 25 years.
Although Hill had developed an interest in construction due to his parents' constant renovating of their home in Cornwall, he had no real influence to get involved in property investing until he began his eye education.
I think the first time that something kind of, you know, I know you asked about a hard moment, maybe something sort of struck within me, was in my second year when I was at college. I was in Plymouth, and we went into rented accommodation to study, and I moved into a house. And it was an old terrace house in Plymouth, which would have been three story, but it had been converted into a four story by utilizing the loft space. And there was 10 students in this place. Some were sharing rooms, and you know, some, and there was a couple who had their own room. I was fortunate to have my own room. I don't know how I managed that. And they'd put in like a couple of different kitchens with like a little space around those, like communal areas. The reason we used to call this building Crackles was because the guy who owned it, and he was a relatively young guy, but he used to wear these kind of these trousers, which had a material which was called a crimpoline. And you could hear him as he walked around the house. He'd bought this house and he'd converted it into, you know, student accommodation. And I got on with it. I was always curious, and I always just talked to people. And I was interested that he was a young guy. He had a nice car, and that was probably what attracted me to him as well, just out of interest. And he was just explaining that he had bought this house, and he'd just bought a second house, and he was doing the same thing. So he was buying houses, letting them to students, which gave him guaranteed rent. In fact, the rent that I paid went directly to him. So, you know, his rental income was guaranteed. And he just kind of explained to me that the students were buying him these properties. Because basically at that time, and, you know, in my early investing in the UK, basically, slightly different to it has been, or historically has been in Australia since I've been here, was that, you know, the rent you could collect would exceed the cost of the loan to hold that property.
So that was quite common over in the UK.
Yeah, it was very easy to do that. Just, you know, the ratio between the cost, the rent collected and the cost of the property made it much more favourable. And that just kind of struck a chord with me that this guy was doing that. Fast forward, I don't know, maybe four or five years. Obviously, I completed my course. I did this sales job as a trainee sales guy. We started to have some success. Me and the other, you know, maybe half of those graduates who came on board also, you know, kicked some goals and got some good results. And then people started to look to buy property. And it was a little bit, yeah, back in that day, I mean, this is in the mid-80s, there's still very much a mindset or a blueprint that, yeah, you go to work, you go to school, you go to work, you get a job, you buy a car, you buy a house, or get married, have kids. It's much more flexible. People have a much more open perspective on the opportunities today, but it's still very much like that. So it was just a natural progression for those people. Once they got a little bit of savings behind them, yeah, their parents or whoever was influencing them would be saying, yeah, you've got some money, don't waste it on a car, a depreciating asset, go and buy yourself get some bricks and mortar. So like the other guys I work with, most of the people went out and they bought like one bedroom apartments or whatever they could afford, new developments, new nice properties for themselves. And I just, at that time, I think this is what resonates with the guy from Plymouth, is I decided I'd go and buy a house. So I bought a four bedroom house as opposed to a one bedroom apartment. And I rented the other three bedrooms out to guys I work with. And we had a lot of fun living in that house. And, you know, I was living there for nothing, yeah, basically, because the rent that I was collecting was covering my mortgage. And I guess that's probably how I started it. I got to, you know, a couple of years down the track, or maybe not even not that long, I got a little bit tired of the sharing, and I went and rented myself a one bedroom flat just not far away, just around the corner.
And you kept that property since then?
Yeah, I kept it. I bought it in 1990. I kept it for 13 years, and then I sold it. And yeah, fortunately, it had more than doubled in value in that time. And when I bought it, it did feel like a bit of a gutsy move. It was like £92,000 at the time, and it's like probably three times the value of my parents' house. It was a lot of money, but it was the right thing to do.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it sounded like it was a great start to your property journey to be able to find a property like that, rent it out to your mates and live there almost next to nothing. It makes absolute sense. And, you know, you guys have a time of your life as well too.
Yeah. I tell you, there's a little funny thing, which is back in the day, which was quite funny. I actually had a phone system installed in there because I was in the phone system business. I had a phone system, which I know had come back from some deal somewhere, and I got one of the technicians to install it at the weekend. So this house had like 10 different telephones in it, so everyone had a phone in their room. We could call between each other, and it even used to print out a bill because it was a system which had been designed to go to a hotel, so everyone could use the phone. Everyone got their own fair slice of the bill, and we had a lot of fun making calls from room to room.
Hill clearly had a lot of fun during his years as a young investor. But what spurred his move to Australia, and how did he manage the properties between the two countries?
Yeah, I came out here in 2000, so yeah, nearly 20 years now. I've been working in telecommunications, and I'd moved to work for a global company which was based in the city of London, which was it was a lot of fun, and fortunately it was well paid, so I was able to invest in other property in the UK. So I bought a couple of units in London, which I could, again, you know, you could, it's almost like as soon as you saved up enough money for a deposit, you could buy another property, let it out, and it was just pretty much cash flow neutral. And fortunately, I say, and it probably wasn't, I don't remember it being particularly strategically done. I just happened to be buying in, and I often encourage investors not to do this. I was buying close to where I lived because I was, I was lazy and it was easy. But that also taught me the lessons of how important that area is, and buying in areas which are in high demand and a scarcity of supply is always going to drive the prices up more readily than in other areas. So I actually came to Australia in 2000. I started dating an Australian girl in London, and she was due to come back, and the industry which I worked in changed massively. I worked for a company for 5 years before that, which was used to be called WorldCom. It's called Verizon now. It's the world's largest telecommunications company. When I started working for them in London, there were 75 people in the business. And then 5 years later, there was like 3,000 or 4,000 people. Culturally massive change. And it didn't suit me so much. I quite like to be innovative and creative in the way which I operated as a sales guy. And I didn't care for the structure and the rules and regulations as much as when it was a smaller business. So it just seemed like a good time to have a change of scenery, and it was an easy option for me, not having travelled extensively, on my own, to come back with this girl to Australia and have and check it out. So we arrived in, I think it was like March in 2001, and I just fell in love with this place as soon as I got here.
So, inspired by Jarl Hill's journey, we'll keep the conversation going in a future episode of Property Investory. We'll discuss how he has acquired 13 properties over his property journey.
When I was buying for a home, I was buying purely with my heart and with no real consideration for the investment potential of that home.
We'll hear about how he navigated the issue of a tenant who refused to pay their rent.
I spoke to him, I tried to see if we could come to some sort of arrangement. And then finally, he moved out.
His time in a development space and what he planned for the future.
What's becoming apparent to me really was that the best way to create wealth through property or build equity is to buy properties in locations which are going to outperform the averages.
And that's next time in a future episode of Property Investory.